If the Mets are at 500, let's say around midseason trade deadline, do they trade Pete Alonso?
Well, I think they have to think seriously about it. I'll say this. The Mets offered him 7 years at $158 million to go into his walk year. That was between it. He didn't go to Scott Boras to get $158 million. He wants to be more like Aaron Judge, the homegrown power hitter, etc. I will say this. I think if David Stearns were sitting there and you had your gavel and forced him to tell the truth, what he would say is that they would have traded him this offseason, but David Stearns didn't want to start his administration by trading this popular player. He saw the Mookie Betts thing with Chaim Bloom up in Boston. He knows that he could get probably as much in July if they're not in it. If they are in it, he just runs out the clock with him. The Mets go, what a second-round draft choice, and they're done with it. You know, maybe, or maybe he comes back because he doesn't get the market. But I think if they're not in it, he'll then do it, and it helps him with the fans because Pete has not played well so far.
True.
Whereas before the season, the fans couldn't know that.
Well, there's plenty of time between now and the trade deadline for him to pick it up. Mr. Met, without the giant head, you're up.
Well, this is a silly anecdote, but I was in spring training with my son. He was there with his two friends. I was taking a picture of them. They turned around. I took another picture. I didn't look at the picture for 2 weeks. Looked at it later. All three of them had Alonso jerseys. That is how popular he is with the fan base. I think people tend to overlook or dismiss also the talent that Pete has. There are not many players in the major leagues who can get up in the morning and you can assure, you're assured that he's going to hit 40 plus home runs. You can make the argument what kind of player he is now, what kind of player he is moving forward, but I think he's an important part of this team. And if you look at the depth of this offensive team and moving forward, I don't know what you do with that depth if you don't have Alonso in it.
So 3-2 to Nimmo. Short lead for McNeil. Now stretching, bouncing around a bit. The payoff pitch. Swing and a drive. Well hit right center. Back goes Harris. Onto the track. It's gone! Unbelievable! Brandon Nimmo, who was not supposed to even swing a bat today, has won the game for the Mets. A two-run homer in the bottom of the ninth inning. They have defeated the Braves 4-3. Nimmo pounces on home plate. The Mets pounce on Nimmo, trying to be respectful and protective of his sore side, but you never know it. A game-winning homer by Brandon Nimmo. Put it in the books. What a win for the New York Mets.
Pete showing signs now. Like I do think that he's getting there. Lindor, obviously, the past couple of weeks. JD, and then we just got to get a couple of the other guys. But once we get going, it could be really fun here.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Monday, May 13th, 2024. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets No G, and don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to welcome in the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on a Monday morning. Boy, does Sunday Night Baseball screw up our schedule here at the Talking Mets Podcast, but a little bit of a late night on Sunday of baseball, well worth it. Brandon Nimmo salvages the weekend. A two-run walk-off homer. I bet you none of you saw that coming. I didn't. And the Mets lose 2 out of 3 to the Braves. And away we go. Happy late Mother's Day to those in the audience. And hope you had a great weekend. And look, this show, as always, like I say, the Sunday Night Baseball scenario always kind of screws us up. So I come to you on this Monday morning. Mets starting a 4-game weird home-and-home series with the Phillies. I'm assuming that's in response to the games in London later in the season. So you'll get the, you know, two in Citi Field, two in Philly. It actually makes a ton of sense. They do that with the Yankees. It's a scheduling situation that you really only see like in hockey or the NBA, but maybe baseball could incorporate some of that where, hey, you know, you're 90 miles south, a bus ride down the turnpike. Why not? Why not play that home and home? But let's get to the situation at hand. So you heard in the beginning the clips. You heard Joel Sherman talking about Pete Alonso and Pete Alonso's contract situation. It's interesting that he leaks some contract information out now, so I'll get to that. And we'll talk about where the Mets are at, because where the Mets are at is largely going to be what drives the Alonso conversation. And I think this conversation that you heard between Darling and Sherman and Costas on MLB Network is just beginning, and I think it's going to be a big theme over the next 60 days. And when you look at the wild card standings this morning, and I think it's time we could start at least peeking at the standings. If you've noticed, I haven't talked about the standings one iota year to date, because until Memorial Day, that getting to know you phase, unless something significant happens where you run away with it one way or the other, it really doesn't matter. But I peeked at the wild card standings this morning, and you're at an inflection point where this getting to know you phase and the Mets, and you heard Mendoza in the open talk about how if this could happen and Pete could get going and JD could get going and Lindor starts to get going, you know, this could be a lot of fun. And I agree with them. But before I get to that, you look at the National League right now, and you have the Phillies playing at a high level. You have the Dodgers, as expected, playing at a high level. The Braves right there behind those two teams in the wild card spot, the top wild card spot. And then you have the central teams, the Brewers and the Cubs, playing at about a 93, 94, 95 win pace right now. We'll see if that continues. And bringing up the rear in the muck, or the beginning of the muck, just like the Mets, just like the Nats, just like the Diamondbacks and the Giants and on and on and on, are the Padres at 500. And they just acquired Arraez about a week ago from the Marlins. So they bolstered up their offense, which has been struggling. You know, team that with Soto a year ago, you know, beat the Mets in the division series in 2022, came back last year with Soto and some of the moves they made, expected to be right up there with the Dodgers. It did not happen. Soto gets traded away. So you look at them right now and, you know, they have some talent up and down that team, but even their offense has tremendously underperforming big name bats in there like Machado and Bogarts. But when you see a lineup with Tatis, Machado, Bogarts, you know, Jerickson Profar, a pesky on-base guy, having a great year, and then a rotation with Darvish, and I know that he's hurt right now, Musgrove, Dylan Cease, you know, and a decent enough bullpen, you know, that's a team that could put on a run. So the real question is, how competitive does this wild card become and how quickly? Because right now, I don't see the Mets as currently constituted with the inconsistencies, especially on offense, being able to play at a 93-94 win pace. And if the wild card falls into that, if you have one of those rare years, and I've done the math, I've gone back about a decade, usually where the third wild card lands, even before they had one historically, you need to be in that 85 to 88 wins. 88 pretty much should ensure you that you're right there for a playoff spot at the end of the year with the third wild card. If it gets higher than that, if the league is top heavy, and right now it looks like it with Colorado and Miami being awful, Cardinals and Reds not playing well, Pirates, we saw them earlier in the year when they came into Citi Field, they were hot early, they haven't played well, but they got their big ace now. So who knows what happens there. You know, the Nats surprising, like the Mets at 500, Giants and D-backs. The Giants have some injuries, D-backs defending NL champs, not playing well. So you have this big muck. And other than Colorado and Miami, who Miami's already waved the white flag, everybody else still has dreams of somehow being in this thing come July 31st. So you have a couple more weeks for this team to figure things out. I've always said, even pre three wild cards, when you had only one wild card, you could probably mess around 500 up until Memorial Day back then. And sometimes a little bit later. I mean, we saw teams like Oakland do that. I've talked about this before. With the three wild card scenario, you could mess around with 500 till almost the deadline, and you could still be in it. And to me, that's a great thing for the game of baseball. Like, I even look at with the NHL and the NBA. The NBA, with some of the rules they've done on salary caps and things like that, and how they've had some markets start to, you know, really put together solid teams. There's a lot more parity now in the league than ever before. Certainly much more parity than when I started watching these sports back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I think it's a good thing when a lot of teams have an opportunity and their fan bases have an opportunity to say, I might be able to do something special, especially in today's day and age where, quite simply, you have too many distractions to just spend time watching bad baseball or non-competitive baseball or investing emotionally in the teams that aren't necessarily going to bear any special fruit at the end of the year. So it keeps especially those peripheral fans on board. But in this particular situation, I think this could get away pretty quickly if the Mets don't turn things around. I thought starting with this weekend against Atlanta and seeing Philadelphia coming in and with the schedule getting a skush tougher at times, you've got to go to Cleveland and whatnot. The inconsistencies that this team has shown on the offensive side, which has really negated a surprising start by the starting rotation. Even with all the walks, they've been able to keep the Mets in games. A bullpen that has taken some big blows with Drew Smith being out and Brooks Raley, who is off to a career year, possibly being done for the year, has withstood those and been pretty good. They've been really opportunistic in the way that they've looked at some of their scrap heap guys. Lopez, Johan Ramirez is back. But I mean, in general, you know, even the guys that you didn't expect much from, I know he was bad last night, Ottavino, they've come back, and whatever the Mets have done, whether it be with their pitching development or just identifying the right pitchers, the bullpen has been pretty good. And they've got guys that they've been able to shuttle that have also come in and been useful. There's been no wave your white flag for the most part relievers on this team. There really hasn't. Everybody's come up and looked rather competitive. So when you see that component, that usually those are the things that undo a team pretty quick. Bad pitching undoes a team pretty quick and makes things completely hopeless for an organization. Because if you can't pitch and you take your team out of the game, I don't care how good you are offensively, you're going to lose a lot of baseball games. I mean, that's been the fact from the beginning of time. You may be entertaining. You know, everybody can say, oh, offense is great. You know, look at that great, you know, 10-9 game. When you lose those games, they're demoralizing. You cannot sustain that kind of offense. Even the best offensive teams, even the most stacked offensive teams, can only average about five and a half runs a game. So if you're giving up 6 or 7, more than likely you're going to lose all of those games, most of those games. So it's a shame as you get to Memorial Day here in a couple of weeks that that's the situation we're in, because when you look at the Mets lineup, you've got, and I'll say, if DJ Stewart's in the lineup, it's actually been a little bit better. But when the guy they sign, a potential borderline Hall of Famer in J.D. Martinez, he joins Narvaez, Anito, McNeil, Lindor, Bader, Marte, as guys who are below league average in that lineup, 7 of the 9, 8 of the 9, if Nimmo's out hurt, are below league average. You don't have a lot of runs to play with. I mean, before Nimmo's walk-off, the Mets were staring down a weekend where they were only going to be able to score, they were only able to score 5 runs against the Braves' rotation, and Chris Sale didn't even pitch. There was, you know, Spencer Strider's out for the year. Yeah, Morton's a good veteran, and Fried is a great pitcher. Almost no hit them. And Elder's the guy bringing up the rear, and they didn't really knock him around. But the Mets were going to go through a weekend against one of the top teams in the league, averaging, you know, less than 2 runs a game. And very reminiscent to the first week of the season when they started out 1-5. Now, I don't know if it's Citi Field, because they seem to be hitting a little bit better on the road. You know, you just saw them, even in Tampa when they lost, they put up some points on the board. They don't seem to play well at Citi Field. You can't blame the fans or the atmosphere. Now, the atmosphere is blah, but I can't blame the fans for that. From what I see on TV, they've kind of quelled the negativity. You know, some of the solid play, you know, the bad play is pretty much sandwiched a solid run there. So you look at this team and you say, okay, listen to Mendoza. He's got that well, when JD gets going and Pete gets going and Lindor gets going, and you start to look at this offensive core right now, your offensive core is Nimmo, Alonso, Lindor, and JD Martinez. McNeil's no longer part of the core. And look, it's ironic how I wrote about it beyond the mic, and I thought they were pieces that were well-received about McNeil's trajectory towards the bench, and then I even suggested late in the week, and you know, sometimes it looks like between the Reed Garrett piece and some of the things we've put out there on Beyond the Mic, the Talking Mets newsletter, that there's been some kind of prescient looking forward, because when I wrote about Reed Garrett, all of a sudden he goes on that run and gets big outs, and now I say, hey, Nimmo, maybe he should go to the middle of the order, and here he is, he hits another, you know, after a couple big hits in St. Louis, hits another big game-winning hit at Citi Field in the ninth inning. You know, so you look at the core offensive players, because right now with the way he's playing and his age, Marte is not a core offensive player. Bader is a defensive guy. Beatty has been, you know, he could potentially compete for a gold glove the way he's playing. He has been an all glove, really very little hit third baseman. McNeil's playing like a backup. The catching position, you get good defense at Anito. You get nothing at Narvaez on both sides. When Alvarez comes back, that should boost the offense. And I think the big decision the Mets have to make there is, will they eat the money on Narvaez and stick with Nito as the backup? Because I think he'll get claimed if they try to send him down. I think he could help a team, you know, even as a backup. So you are so predicated on those four guys hitting. And when you look at those four guys, Nimmo's having, because he's gotten hot in May, he's back to kind of his career norms about the run creator that he has. He's becoming a run producer. I mean, he's leading the team in RBIs from the leadoff spot. And Alonso has started to play a little bit better. I mean, he had a couple of big hits yesterday. The third time up in the eighth inning, he just got under one, which would have been a big, I think, two or three run homer. But he's starting to percolate a little bit. And, you know, Lindor has been inconsistent and has shown flashes. He has gotten a little bit better, but he's nowhere near what you'd expect out of him. And, you know, the thing about JD Martinez, you know the guy could hit, and you look at him up there at the plate. He almost hits a game-tying homer on Friday, and I watched him batting practice in Tampa a week ago. The guy could hit. The guy could go the opposite way. The ball jumps off his bat. But the question you have with someone like that is, what does he turn into, a pumpkin at the age of 36 with a back that he's admitted has had some issues, a back that needed to be shot up in spring training, in his extended spring training, a back that he said had to be shot up last year, and he made it through the season? That is the most concerning part about JD Martinez, because if JD Martinez has struck midnight and the Mets are left holding the bag for a little bit, you know, a little bit of money, there really is no reinforcements on the way. Yeah, you could say Tyrone Taylor, who's off to a nice start as a backup, maybe could pop in. Is DJ Stewart for real? Yeah, he's like Kyle Schwarber. He'll hit for no average, but he gets on base. He pops home runs. He works the count. I mean, he's got more walks than strikeouts. Who would have had that on their bingo card going into the beginning of the season? So you look up and down this lineup, the solutions that you see with the pitching, how the Mets have been able to bring up Christian Scott, how they've been able to, you know, work carefully with Senga and not rush him back. You know, how they have guys like Peterson and McGill, whether you like them or not, they are quality depth pieces on a big league roster. How potentially you could go down into the minors at a Tidwell or a Hamill or a Sproat, maybe not this year with Sproat, Tyler Stewart, you know, Mike Vasil is not pitching well, but there are some options to even bring further depth to the rotation. How they've been able to shuttle effectively, even with guys with options, and keep them, and even reacquire them in the case of guys like Tonkin and Johan Ramirez with the bullpen. Everything that they've done positive to piece this pitching staff together at times, like every team in baseball needs to be pieced together. They can't do with this offense because they don't have any options. Their options are what's on the big league roster. Other than Luis Angel Acuña, who's starting to hit a little bit at Syracuse, possibly pushing his way into the equation. And I could see a scenario where McNeil becomes Wendell's role later in the year, and Acuña maybe gets a chance at second base. I mean, that might be something and which would add a component of athleticism and speed that this team lacks right now. There is nothing else. Gilbert has been hurt, and a non-factor AAA. I don't know if their other guys are really out there, have anything to, right now as outfielders. I don't know if anybody who's ready. I know there's some interesting names down there, but I don't think anybody's ready. So the guys that you're going to be relying on are on this roster. The guys that are going to get this done and have some capacity based on projections and what we talked about going into the season, there is hope that this team could score high fours, maybe even five runs a game. And when they were hot, back when they were out in the West Coast in L.A. And San Francisco and whatnot, they did. They scored over six runs a game for a period going back to the end of that homestand, that second homestand that they played really well. So, you know, this is all where this team is at. And it's going to be essentially over the next couple of weeks, will the guys play to the back of their baseball cards or the front of their baseball reference pages, however you want to talk about that old line that we grew up talking about. Back in the day, it was back of the baseball card. Now it's digital, FanGraphs page, baseball reference page. That's, you just have to sit back and wait for that. And it's either going to happen or it's not. And if it's not, well, that gets to what the big question is, the $158 million question, and that's Pete Alonso. Because the worst case scenario for David Stern in this Pete Alonso situation, and it's starting to percolate. You heard Sherman on the MLB Network leak the information about what Alonso was offered this offseason and what he declined. There's a reason for that. There's a reason why that was floated. That was either floated by the Mets or someone in the Mets organization to send a message to everybody. Maybe send a message to Pete. You want to get paid. You got to be better. Maybe Boris put it out there to show the world where the Mets are at so that they could get a feel about what kind of offer they want to make, if they want to maybe trade for him and re-sign him. But right now, where the Mets are at with that third wild card hovering around the 500 mediocre mark, and the league in general showing that there's really, I'm not so sure that the Cubs and the Brewers are going to stay at 93-94 win paces. I'd have to, you know, they're solid teams. I've seen them play. They're solid teams. They're not bad teams. They got, you know, they got some good components, but I'm not sure they're going to stay at that pace. So they might tick it down a little bit to the high 80s, which would then put the wild card imminently in reach and more than just that third spot for the Mets, depending on where they're at in the next 30 to 45 days. And that scenario is a nightmare scenario, not because you want to not compete and make the playoffs and do all the things that we've talked about this team being able to do since all the way back to Christmas. But it would put Stearns in that impossible situation. A tough job coming in here, firing a manager that had some success, coming in where the yoke is, how angry the fans are, all the disappointment. I mean, he's not getting no benefit of the, you know, honeymoon period with Cohen. The honeymoon period's over. The Cohen honeymoon period is long over. So he comes in here, and look, I think the media has been pretty fair to him. I think the fans have been more unfair than the media in a lot of ways. And, you know, things have quelled from some of the nonsense, silly talk that we saw throughout the offseason when they weren't, other than Yamamoto, really heavy in on big-name free agents. A lot of that has proven to be prescient. I mean, maybe they should have been on another Japanese import, Imanaga, who's off to this hot start, but we'll see over the course of that contract and the season who he really is. But he's been outstanding. He's been what they thought Yamamoto would be. Maybe that's the only one you could really criticize. But he now is faced with the ultimate tough decision, which is going to be made even tougher by the fact that there's going to be maybe some uncertainty about how real this team is come the deadline. Because even if they are an 85, 86, 87 win team that could sneak into that third wild card spot, however, there might not be a feeling that this team could go far with that playoff spot. How do you handle offers for Pete Alonso? Because they're going to be there. They're going to be there. There's going to be a team that needs a bat that looks at Pete and says, look, I don't know if I can re-sign him, but I know this guy could get hot. And listen to what Darling said. He's absolutely correct. There are not many players in baseball that you could pencil in for 40 home runs. Even now, with how he's played, this has been the worst version of Alonso that was projected since he came up. And I think the only season that perhaps you could compare this to is the 50-game pandemic shortened season for 2020. His sophomore season wasn't great during COVID. But we really didn't get a chance to dissect it and assess it because it wasn't real in terms of scheduling and travel. We were distracted with all the other stuff going on around the world. You just wanted to get that season in and over with in some capacity. It's a season that should have never been played. And nobody really talked about it because he was good in 2021. He was really good in 2022. And even though he wasn't the same in 23, he didn't decline in any way that, you know, made you feel there was a problem. This year, though, and maybe it stands out because it started in April at the beginning of the year when you could see it on the page. It's not like his numbers are normal, but within those numbers are these soft periods. You could see the softness in totality on his baseball reference page. You know, is when the beginning of the questions are, well, you're starting to see the fans say, hey, is Pete really worth what he wants? I've been saying all the way back to 2 years ago, much to the laughter of some people, he's going to want $30 million a year. And people say, you're crazy, he's not worth it. Had conversations with good baseball friends of mine over the last couple of weeks. And everyone, Mets fans, huge Mets fans, they're basically like, hey, there's no way this guy is worth $30 million a year. I actually had someone suggest to me, and I chuckled, you know, after he said it, because it's really the only option. He says, ah, trade Alonso, put Stewart and Vientos platoon at first base. I mean, that's probably, if you trade Alonso, what you're staring at is a Vientos first base every day. Hey, kid, you got, you know, that happens in July. Go at it, rip it for 60 days. We're in a wild card race. Now, this becomes a lot easier. If Pete's hovering around the 120 OPS, OPS plus, 750 OPS, he pops a couple of home runs here and there, but he's hitting 220, low on base percentage. You know, he's okay defensively, but nothing special. If that's where he's at come the end of July, even with this team in the race, and I understand he has a presence at the plate that changes a lineup. So you can't just go by numbers. You can't just say, well, Vientos could do that, because A, we don't know if Vientos could do that. B, even if he can, Vientos is not going to get the respect and fear that will change the way others in the lineup are pitched to that Alonso brings. He's still Pete Alonso. I told you the story last week in Tampa. When he's struggling, I would have pitched to him instead of J.D. Martinez. Maybe I take that back watching J.D. hit since then, but because, you know, but he still used Pete Alonso, and they intentionally walked him with a base open, and that's what happens. But, you know, you get to the deadline, even in that case, and Stearns is faced with that decision of an offer for Alonso with a team that's kind of in the, is not kind of, in the wild card race and kind of a contender, because there's debate about our third wild cards or wild card teams other than the top one really contenders. After what he did a couple of years ago, trading Hader and pretty much demoralizing that clubhouse. Remember, the clubhouse, it's all about politics with the deadline with the clubhouse. When you don't make a move, it looks like you're not investing in the club. When you take an important piece, even though from a standpoint of numbers, it doesn't change really overall the odds or the ability for a team to compete and make the postseason. But for those players in that clubhouse, it's a sign of, we don't believe in you enough to really invest in you. It could have a demoralizing impact. It could not be a worse scenario for Stearns. You know what would make this easy for Stearns? The Padres get hot. The Cubs and Brewers stay at a 94-95 win pace. The Phillies and Braves are going to, let's say, potentially continue to play at a high level. I think the Phillies haven't been challenged yet with their schedule. We'll see, but they're going to be good. They're going to be a 90-win-plus team. And you start to look at the wild card standings. You see the Padres start to creep more towards the Dodgers than down towards the muck, and you're five or six games out mid to late July, and you're like, look, we're 5 to 6 games back of a wild card, third wild card. It's going to be very tough to make that happen. This is the right move to do for the future. We love Pete, but, you know, can we get, or is there a deal on the table where, even if he's not having a career year, that, you know, the Mets can make out pretty well. And, you know, historically, you know, these kind of players, I mean, McGuire got traded, but they didn't get much for him. The A's, when they traded him, I think they got some pitchers, and I don't know what they were considered at the time, the Cardinals pitchers. But what you could hope the Mets can do, and I don't know, because he was having a really, really good year when Texas traded him. But back in 2007, the Rangers traded Mark Teixeira, who was having a great year, to the Braves, and the Braves got Elvis Andrus, who wound up being a starting shortstop on a pennant-winning team, Neftali Feliz, who was a closer on a pennant-winning team, Jared Saltalamacchia, who was a starting catcher in the big leagues. You know, Matt Harrison, who is a solid pitching prospect and wound up doing okay. And actually was a good starter for them on those teams that went to the World Series. They did really, really well in that trade. And they got guys who helped them over the next five-year period and helped them win a pennant. All from the rental of Mark Teixeira. Now, Teixeira, you know, came back to Atlanta. He had some time on his contract. And then they wound up trading him to Anaheim in a little bit of a different type of deal. So Teixeira is kind of a blueprint here, another former Boris client who, you know, could go out and be a comp to what maybe the Mets could get for Lonzo. And when you start to look at it from the Teixeira lens, if there is a Teixeira Texas deal on the table, now that's best case scenario. Well, guess what? You have to seriously consider this more than ever. Even if they're a few games behind the third wild card spot, and they're in the same muck with the Nats and the Giants, and who else, you know, is there. You want to know how this becomes a non-factor? Play better. To quote the old Mets manager, Buck, play better. Start it consistently, because I think unless this is truly a 500 team, when they start hitting, they're going to, their pitching is going to go to hell in a handbag, which I really don't see, especially because there is solid reinforcements on the way, and the veterans all can stay competitive within a 5 to 6 inning range. I mean, they're going to burn the bejesus out of the bullpen, I think, but you know, that's baseball in 2024. I don't think the Mets are all that much different. I have to really dive into bullpen innings to see if the Mets are that much different than the rest of the league. I haven't done that yet. I'm suspecting they're not. Play better. You know, get into that 86, 87, 88 win, you know, area, which if you score the way you're expecting and you get the offense you would expect from J.D. Martinez, from Pete Alonso, from Lindor, from Nimmo, you know, that's enough. Now, you need your component players like McNeil, like Marte to be better. That's where this gets interesting, because I don't know if they could be better. I don't know if Marte's age has gotten to him. McNeil, I can't figure out. McNeil has gone from a hybrid of Pete Rose and Daniel Murphy to basically Joey Wendell. I mean, he had a really fun bunt there. I mean, reminded me of Wally Backman in the 86 NLCS with that drag bunt. You know, how he dragged it against Dave Smith before the Dykstra home run. Not in the same suspense or same stakes, but you know, similar type of setup there before the Nimmo home run. You know, I don't know if they have their component players. I mean, they have guys who are solid baseball players like Bader. You know, McNeil still plays some pretty good defense. You know, Beatty, tremendous with the glove. Can he show consistency with the bat? You know, he'll get two home runs like he did in Tampa, and then he doesn't do anything the rest of the weekend. You know, that's a big question. So, basically, the talk of Alonso has started. The $158 million question. And the deadline's just a couple of months away. It's closer than you think. I mean, think about it. Within 60 days, 8 weeks, and it goes by quick, we're going to be talking about this in some capacity. Either it's going to be completely on the back burner because the Mets are firmly showing that they are a serious playoff contender and they're showing good bones. Or if they're in the same kind of, you know, spot, a couple of games out of the wild card, meandering around 500, it'll get louder. Now, you have to think, hearing the offer, and Sherman is a guy that I don't think would just throw that out there if it wasn't real. And you don't know context to that offer. There could have been back and forth. That could have been an opening offer. What he got is a snapshot in time offer. You have no idea how that went back and forth. I think the Mets are, you know, or at least Stearns and whatnot, were throwing an offer out there that you only do if you want to get a good value. I don't think that they're scared of going to free agency with Alonso. Look, they did it with Diaz. At that time, you know, arguably it was the best closer season in history, one of them. They did it with Nimmo, an elite run creator who everybody knew was going to have a market. If anybody, you know, especially in an analytically driven world, you know, before analytics, people, unless you watch Nimmo play for you every day, wouldn't appreciate what he brings. But now, you know, with analytics, it's an easy thing. But for the Mets to go and offer about a $23, $24 million contract, AAV per year, to Alonso, you know, look, here's a guy who, yes, he according to Fangraphs, He averaged about $23 million in value in 2023. But that's the low point of his career. He's been 30 and close to 30 or north of 30 for a majority of his career in terms of his value. That's, you know, all the blend that a Fangraphs does to put a dollar value on performance. That's what he's been. You know, he's been in the league, what, 5 years at $126 million total value dollars? Well, let's just do the math there real quick. 126, and some of you guys in the audience probably already have it, but I need a calculator. 126 divided by 5 is about $25 million. And in that total is the COVID season. So if you take the COVID season out, you know, you're looking at a $31 million a year player. And that's what he's going to want, $30 million a year, $31 million a year. And anything that the Mets come that doesn't have a 3-0 under the AAV, it ain't going to work. 7-1, 7-2-10, that works. You know, maybe he wants a few extra years. He's going to want $30 million a year. And right now, Boris is telling him, I could get you that $50 or $60 million. And maybe he's promising more. I'm sure Boris is going to go and have a binder that tells everybody he's Aaron Judge. And guess what? You know, Aaron Judge, you know, maybe not in the same offer delta that you see right now. But Aaron Judge went out and set the American League record for home runs when he became a free agent. Yeah, he had a 210 OPS plus. He had a slugging of nearly 700. He won the MVP. Pete hasn't put up numbers like that ever, that kind of level. He's never put up that kind of numbers. I mean, Aaron Judge is there are years that he's been as good as Aaron Judge. You look at Aaron Judge's total years. When he plays 150 plus games, which is rare, it's only been a couple of times, you know, he's been really good, but you know, Pete's in the same bandwidth of him. I mean, maybe Judge is a little bit better on base guy, walks a little bit more. But when you look at Judge's nine-year career, he's only had 2 years where he's played 100. I mean, he played 148 games in 2021, 157 in 2022. And I'm sure that's what Cashman and team, I should go back to his first full year, he played 155 games. When he plays every day and he's not hurt, he's way better than Pete. Now, that's the question with Judge, is he healthy? Because you've seen some of that. You know, at 32, you've seen some of that decline. And that's the other thing. Pete's entering his 30s now. If he's already showing some of these inconsistencies before he gets the big contract, what's he going to look like at 37 or 38? It could get ugly. And then you got $30 million on the payroll. And maybe that's part of the existence of being a big market team, that you're always going to have somebody, whether it be Cano, Scherzer, Verlander, maybe down the road, Lindor and Pete, some kind of dead money that you're paying for because you have to pay at the back end of the contract to make the contract value what it needs to be to get the good times at the beginning of the contract. So really, the unfortunate part of all this, unless the Mets start really coming together, and Mendoza seems to think they can, I haven't seen the offense come together yet. There's every reason to believe that Pete's having a contract meh year, and that Martinez is declining, and that Lindor, for some reason, is having a bad year. It happens. And we have no idea if you ever see Jeff McNeil return to the Jeff McNeil that was Pete Rose type. That's the Jeff McNeil we all knew and loved. And is Marte ever going to be more than a below league average to league average hitter component player that shows flashes of himself? And you can't rely on the catcher until Alvarez comes back and the center fielder, because they're there for their glove. They're not there for their bat. So if you're asking them to do more than who they are, that's when you know that there's a problem. And, you know, I'm not so sure Beatty's ever going to hit in the big leagues. Look, I questioned Beatty on the defensive side. I was wrong, way wrong. But I still don't see a guy that hits a hell of a lot more than he did a year ago. Yeah, his glove is where it needs to be. I'll take his glove. Got to get that bat to show a little bit more pop, a little bit more consistent. I'm not expecting him to be 120, 130 OPS plus like the other guys. I wish he would be. Just be a little bit above league average and have competitive quality at bats. Hit the ball hard, hit the ball out of the ballpark every once in a while. Maybe do some gappers, some doubles instead of these little bloop singles. The glove's fine. So it'll be really interesting, because as we get to the final couple of weeks of the getting to know you phase, the Pete Alonso contract situation has now been brought up. And he is going to hold a very big key to where this team goes forward, because he can potentially land some very useful pieces to rebuild the offense potentially, or maybe even bring in more pitchers with his, with him being an asset at the deadline. It will be wildly controversial whichever direction the Mets go. Stearns better be ready for his first, the judge and jury of New York will be out in full force if he trades Alonso. If he doesn't, it'll still be out there. Then it'll be more about, hey, can they get this guy signed? Because if they make a wild overpay for Pete Alonso, and there's no guarantee they could sign Soto away from the Yankees. You know, Bregman's out there. I don't have the free agent list in front of me, but, you know, there's a few names out there. You know, it might come down to where if you tie yourself into Pete for the next 6 or 7 years, well, guess what? You know, he's the core of your team and everything your team emanates from. And if he's bad, you got yourself a problem. Less likely he's going to be bad than signing a pitcher for a long-term deal, but there's some risk there. And you also don't want recency bias with Pete and say, okay, the version we see this year, which is not the best Pete Alonso version, is the version you're going to get going for, because that might not be the case. He might just be having, you know, the ebbs and flows of a career. Although you saw a dip last year and you're seeing the dip again this year and you haven't even signed them to a long-term deal. That's usually not a good sign. Let's put it that way. So the Mets have some time. We're in the back stretch of the getting to know you phase. Here's what we know. We know that David Stearns knows how to put together a bullpen. We don't know if the bullpen will survive being burnt to a crisp, but he's been able to navigate the bullpen through the first 6 or 7 weeks, even with some big injuries. The rotation, which has some reinforcements along the way, hasn't been great. They walk too many batters. They don't go long enough, but they're keeping the team in the game. It's been the inconsistency of the offense, an offense that as easily could score only 1 to 2 runs a game as it can 5 or 6. And you're seeing too many periods where they're scoring 1 to 2 runs a game, and then they'll have a period where they'll score 5, 6, 7 runs for a couple of games or a week, and then they go back to 1 to 2 runs. That needs to be more consistently like they were in 2022. They weren't a bully offense. Go out there and give me 4, 4.5 on average runs per game. They will win ball games. They'll be in close games, but they are built to win close games. They've proved they can win close games. They're not afraid of close games. Now, it's a problem for the team because they burn you out on more ways than one, emotionally, physically, bullpen-wise. But if that's where they're at, this is a team that's built to win close games, and you know, they could be in this thing for the long haul. And then, you know, it's really going to be fascinating, even if they're in the race, even if they're actually in a play. I think if they're in a spot, a wild card spot, even by a game or two, come the deadline, I don't see how they could trade Alonso at that point. I mean, I know analytics guys, analytics GMs, analytics type of thought is like, hey, that shouldn't matter. But there is a politics and a marketing of a team that's already had themselves poorly, they've themselves have poorly marketed this season, where I think a lot of the attendance, and this was written about, I think it was Puma at the Post, wrote about it, where because they talked about a step back, I think the fans said, hey, I'm going to step back with my wallet. I'm not going to go watch this team. When in reality, they just weren't, they were taking a step back from being in the deep end of the free agent pool and trying to build a roster a little bit more sustainable roster. It should have been explained better. Epler wasn't the guy to explain it. I'm not sure Cohen knew how to explain it. It's tough to explain no matter what. When an owner comes in and spends wildly and has the kind of pocketbook that Cohen has, it's really hard to explain and market that situation. So tons of questions. This is the next 60 to 75 days are going to be very defining for the next couple of years, 2 to 3 years in the Stearns regime. Because the decision he makes with Pete could reverberate going forward. And it could be good or it could be bad. And I got to tell you, I don't have an easy answer. First of all, I don't know what offers are out there. I'm not ready to write Pete off, but I'm concerned. And right now, I'm not so sure that the Mets, at least this current offensive version, could be any more than a 500 team. And that, to me, with, as I look at the wild card here on this May 13th morning, I'm not sure if that's going to be good enough to stay within a reasonable distance, especially if San Diego gets their stuff together. And God forbid San Diego starts getting hot and playing at the Dodger level. All the Mets are in a bad position. They're basically, you know, they're going to spend the summer win one, lose one, and entertaining the fans with some individual performances and some giveaways and some nice days, you know, Strawberry's retirement ceremony. But that'll be all you'll get the rest of the season. Too soon to tell if that's the case. But we're going to start to see things crystallize over the next couple of weeks. And when we kind of put a bow on, hey, this is where they're at and this is where they're going forward, right around Memorial Day, right after Memorial Day, then, you know, we'll have a little bit more of an in-depth conversation. But the first shot of the bow about Pete, what Pete has been offered, what he rejected, I think the in this situation, the fans, and I have to think it came from the Mets because the fans reacted negatively. Well, Pete, what does he want? Pete wants $30 million AAV a year. I've been telling you that for 2 years, even before it became reported in the media. It was common sense, knowing what he's achieved, the market for first basemen, how, you know, rare a power specimen that Pete is in this world of baseball. There was a lot of double negatives in that. Jeez, that was not the most linguistically solid way to end the show ever. But anyway, all right. Hope everybody enjoys themselves this week. Enjoy another week of baseball. Thanks for tuning in this Monday morning to the latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. I don't have the schedule in front of me. I don't know when the next Sunday night baseball game is, but we'll figure it out. As always, sometimes we come to you before the Sunday night baseball game, sometimes after the Sunday night baseball game, sometimes the morning after. But anyway, you can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silvat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silvat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG, and don't forget the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. Enjoy your Monday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.